This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in Boston, the New Jersey Nets, riding a clutch three-pointer in the closing seconds by Keith Van Horn, beat the Celtics in Game 6 of their Eastern Conference Final Series 96-88 to win that series 4-2. Jason Kidd and his Nets teammates will watch Game 7 of the Western Conference Final tomorrow to see whom they'll play for the championship. Last night in Los Angeles, the Lakers extended that series to a seventh game by beating the Kings 106-102. In Game 7 of the National Hockey League's Western Conference Finals, the Detroit Red Wings hammered the Colorado Avalanche 7-0. No, that's not a baseball score. The Red Wings thus earned the right to meet the Carolina Hurricanes for the Stanley Cup. That final series begins on Tuesday night in Detroit. Are those chants emanating from NBA and NHL luxury boxes? No, they're skipping over the oceans and arriving on our shores, albeit a bit delayed from the sights of the 2002 World Cup soccer tournament. Joining me now on the line from Korea, which shares with Japan the distinction of hosting this year's World Game extravaganza, is John Powers of the Boston Globe. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
The great upset that everybody always expects in the World Cup came in Game 1.
Acquiabla, as they say.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. Senegal obviously wasn't expected to knock off defending champion France. I already saw one account that said France was lazy, but they didn't look lazy to me.
No, I think France was unlucky a bit, but I think also what happened is that the magic of 4 years ago doesn't travel well. The irony is, this was the first World Cup match they played after beating Brazil in Paris, but this isn't Paris and this wasn't Brazil. I think what you saw was a team with nothing to lose in Senegal that people really haven't seen before. This was the first World Cup match they had ever played, and a team in France that has a lot of pressure on it. Everyone expects that they'll win, and certainly no one expected that they would lose to Senegal.
All right, Argentina has proven in the past you can come in the favorite, lose the first match, and make it all the way to the final, so perhaps it's not time for France to despair quite yet.
Well, I think that is true, but it's a little more difficult for the French, and they have two tough teams left. Uruguay and Denmark are not people that you want to take lightly. So what has happened is that France, after just one match, is out of margin. They have to win again.
John, the tournament, of course, has 32 teams, 8 groups, vying for 2 weeks to move on to a round of 16 teams. Some of the experts with whom I've spoken have suggested that what really characterizes the World Cup this time around is how wide open the tournament is. I wonder if the players feel that way as well.
Well, what's happened is basically you've got one team that has no doubts. Argentina clearly is the class of South America. People thought France was the class of Europe. I think that certainly there's enough balance in the groups, and most teams don't really travel well. No European team has ever won the cup when it was not in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think that this might be the year that someone else slides in. What you do have now is a Brazil team that is down, that struggled to qualify, a German team that its own people don't think is going to go much further than the final eight. Italy is okay, but Italy has a problem. Every time that they play and it comes down to penalty kicks, they lose. So I think that once you go to a place in the world that the World Cup has never been, which is Asia, all bets are off. I mean, this is completely foreign territory for everybody except the Koreans and the Japanese. No one's ever been here before.
Over the next few days, you will see Paraguay play South Africa, China against Costa Rica, and of course the first U.S. match when they take on Portugal. Which matches are you particularly looking forward to seeing?
Well, I think the Brazil-China match intrigues everybody. You've got Bora Milutinovic, who's called Milu by the Chinese. He is taking his fifth different team to the World Cup. China has never qualified before. That is a match everyone is looking forward to. U.S.-Portugal is a very intriguing match. I mean, this everyone thinks that Portugal could win the World Cup, yet the U.S. is feeling very confident. They think they might be able to steal a point in that match.
You mentioned Brazil, which they did have sort of a slump trying to qualify, but then they played very well very recently. Do you anticipate Brazil's return to greatness?
I think one of the problems with the Brazilians, it's a team that operates on rhythm. It's a team that needs to be together. And, of course, as their players have gotten better, they all play in Europe. So once you get the Brazilian team together on the same page, in the same rhythm, in the same dance for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you start to see it come back. So I think a lot of people are hoping, certainly, that you have a good, feisty Brazil team here. I mean, clearly, they have not been the same since they got demolished by the French in the 1998 final. And Ronaldo had not been the same player. He's been hurt. He seems to be back fit. And I think that is what, in order to have a carnival at the World Cup, you need Brazil to go well deep.
It's traditional to pick a so-called group of death, and I would think that that would be Group F, which includes Argentina, England, Nigeria, and Sweden all playing in Japan. But does Korea have a group of death all its own among the four groups playing there?
Absolutely. I think that this is a group that nobody really wanted to play in. If you look at the Portuguese team, they came very close to making the European final. Poland was the first team in Europe to qualify, and back in the 70s and 80s, they were very strong. This is their first time back since 1986. And the U.S., when it plays well, has done very well. Their problem has always been, can they play well for 90 minutes?
I read that the U.S. team was met by an enormous security presence when the team arrived in Korea. Is the security everywhere evident as you kind of move around?
I think it is very evident when teams are involved. I mean, certainly the U.S., anytime they go to practice, they've got motorcycles and police and escorts and, you know, flashing lights. They are not used to that much security, but they don't mind it. I think what is funny here, actually, and you see this a lot in Japan, the terrorists they're worried about are the English lagerlouts.
Mm-hmm.
They have had many practice hooligan brawls out on the streets of Japan just to make sure that their people are in fighting trim. But this is something that the World Cup is not used to. They're used to violent fans. They're not used to terrorists who don't come with tickets.
Is it fun to be there? I mean, every time I read about increased security at something like the Olympics or the World Cup, I worry that the carnival atmosphere won't survive the presence of heavily armed security people. What about that?
Well, so far, there is a huge carnival atmosphere here, which people were more concerned about because it's so far away and so expensive to go. I mean, many of the Argentine fans who normally would be here, they have so little money that nobody could really travel here. And I think that you will see tons of Chinese, obviously, coming. You will always have a big brass band from Brazil. One issue, however, is this is the first time that the World Cup has been split between two countries. So you only have half of the teams in any one country. That is what I think is being mourned here a bit, is that if you're in Korea, you won't see Italy, you won't see Argentina, you won't see Germany. If you're in Japan, you won't see the French and you won't see the Brazilians. So I think that is what has been lost here, and I think they hope to get back in Germany in 2006.
John Powers writes about soccer, among other things, for the Boston Globe. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Because the World Cup tournament is taking place half a world away, watching the games in real time will often mean getting up very early in the morning. For example, the U.S. and Portugal begin their game on Wednesday at 4:55 a.m. Eastern Time. True World Cup fans are not dismayed by the timing.
I'm going to either definitely try and get up the 7 o'clock game, so maybe the 4 o'clock is kind of pushing it. But if the U.S. play in the morning, I'll try and definitely watch it. I'm excited.
That's U.S. national women's team veteran Christine Lilly, who played on World Cup winning sides in 1991 and 1999. Her teammate on the WUSA's Boston Breakers, German national Maren Meinert, gets a break in this cup. The German men's team's first-round games will all be televised at 7:25 a.m. Eastern Time. Still pretty early for a pro athlete, but Meinert says she will be watching.
Yes, I will. They are early in the morning, but I try to watch as many as I can. I will get up early and get in my bed in the evening very early.
At practice early this week, some of Maren Meinert's teammates were trying to make plans to see some of the games together. That's a possibility that's also occurred to several members of the New England Revolution, midfielder Steve Ralston among them.
Just in the locker room, they had something on about it, and we were trying to get together like a little pool or something like that if we can. Or, you know, I'm sure we will get together at one point and get the guys together. I'm sure the team will probably set something up where we can get together and go watch a game somewhere.
Just got to designate somebody to cook pancakes or omelets, and there you go, right?
Sure. I know it won't be my wife. She doesn't do a whole lot of cooking. But maybe we can get somebody else to come in and do it for us.
Wherever Mr. Ralston looks for a cook, he's unlikely to find someone who'll provide a spread as brilliant as the one Roger Howell is planning.
We have our English breakfast. I mean, we have a huge traditional meal, which we affectionately call the greedy bastard here, which has, you know, egg, sausage, bacon, beans, toast. It's a big breakfast. We also, you know, we serve a traditional English breakfast of bacon and eggs here.
Here is a San Francisco pub called Mad Dog in the Fog. It'll be open at 7 a.m. Pacific time for live games throughout the tournament, with replays throughout the day. Howell, a co-owner of the place, says soccer fans in great numbers have enjoyed previous World Cup broadcasts, and they've been watching Premier League and MLS games as well as other matches at the Mad Dog for years.
It's like being at the game. You know, people will be singing, people will be drinking, people will be jostling each other. The supporters of each team will be needling each other.
From coast to coast, World Cup devotees will be recognizable over the next few weeks by the darkening circles under their eyes, a circumstance that has New England Revolution coach Steve Nichol, who played for Scotland in the 86 World Cup, hoping his players will keep the entertainment in perspective.
I mean, they are soccer players, and if you're a soccer player, you're interested in the World Cup. So I'm sure they will be, but again, I would imagine, and I would certainly hope that nobody's coming in training after being up all night watching the game.
Non-players who choose to view live World Cup action from now until the end of the month can only hope their employers will be more understanding.
In the spell of your charms, hold me close in your arms while we're dancing the World Cup walls, romancing.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Over the past several weeks, mountain climbers from Japan, South Korea, and elsewhere have removed more than 2 tons of garbage from Mount Everest. According to team leader Ken Noguchi, the mountain is still littered with more than 100 tons of trash, including plastic, gas cartridges, and empty oxygen bottles, some of which have been there for 50 years. We found more garbage on the Nepalese side than on the north side in Tibet, said Noguchi, who has become something of an authority on litter at the top of the world. He previously led 2 cleaning expeditions that hauled more than 3 tons of trash off the mountain.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Century 21 Fine Homes and Estates. More information on their luxury listings is available at century21.com/MA. Century 21, real estate for the real world. And by the Music Emporium of Lexington. For more than 30 years, supplying acoustic guitars, banjos, and mandolins to everyone, from the professional to the aspiring beginner. TheMusicEmporium.com. There is new violence in South Asia as the U.S. and other Western governments warn nuclear neighbors India and Pakistan to exercise restraint and avoid all-out war. Read more at WBUR.org. Mostly sunny, breezy, very warm today. Highs 81 to 86 in the 70s on the Cape and the Island. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, breezy, cooler. Highs in the 70s, cooler in the Cape and the Islands. It's a chance of rain tonight.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Ron Thomas, author of They Cleared the Lane, the NBA's Black Pioneers. But first, Brass Bonanza was for years the official song of the Hartford Whalers, Connecticut's NHL franchise from 1979 to 1997, after which the team swapped its green and blue jerseys for Carolina Hurricane red and black. On Tuesday, just 5 years after the move south, the pro team hailing from North Carolina will vie for the Stanley Cup. Joining me now on the line from his home in Hartford is Sean Tracy, 20 years a Whalers fan. And Sean, I guess we should begin by asking if you're rooting for the Hurricanes to go all the way.
No, I'm not. I was rooting for them to not make the playoffs, actually.
Isn't it hard to root against the players who were on the Whalers? I mean, I'm counting. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 guys who were Whalers alums on that team.
Yeah, not many of them were with the Whalers too long. I mean, aside from Ronnie Francis, who was great with the Whalers, but he's already won a cup. And I don't want to see Carmanos benefit from anything.
This is bitterness over the owner, I take it.
Yes, Pierre Carmanos, the guy who bought the Whalers, he pretty much stole them from Hartford, really. He bought them with the intention of moving them and took them down to North Carolina.
Now, apparently recent attendance has been very good for the Hurricanes, as you might expect, a team that's gotten as far as they have. But Raleigh wasn't exactly going wild over this team in the regular season. Would Hartford still be a better place for the team?
Oh, I think for sure they would. I mean, they always had support. They threw a parade when they won the Adams division in Hartford.
division-winning ticker tape parade. That's great. Now, I understand that you're moving to Toronto very soon. Is this because you're a Leafs fan and want a team to call your own?
Oh, no, it's not. No, it's not. I'm moving up there. My wife is up there. I just finished school here in Hartford, and I'm moving on up there.
Okay, so you don't feel bad that the Hurricanes beat the Leafs 4-2 in the Eastern Conference Final this time around?
No, well, I felt bad watching it because I was praying to God Toronto would knock them out, but no such luck.
How do people in Hartford feel now? You've got the Hartford Wolfpack of the American Hockey League team there. Does that feel like something that's about the right size, or would they still welcome an NHL team coming back to Hartford?
Oh, they would definitely welcome an NHL team back to Hartford. I haven't gone to any of the Wolfpack games yet. I don't know. It's hard to go from watching the NHL to the AHL. There's a huge jump there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think this city could really use an NHL team.
Is the general feeling among former fans of the Hartford Whalers, hey, once they left, we're not interested? Or is there a group of people who still root for the ex-Whalers, now the Hurricanes?
You can definitely find Carolina fans here. And there's definitely people who root for Ron Francis. And I'd like to see Ron Francis doing well. He's always been classy. But there's quite a number of people who are kind of bitter over the loss of the Whalers. It's just the way that it happened, the way that the owner, Peter Carmanos, took them away. He didn't have a lot of class in the way he did it.
Does Brass Bonanza still stir your heart when you hear it?
Oh, yeah, I still have it on tape. I'll listen to it in the car sometimes, probably on the way up to Toronto.
Sean Tracy, for whom a Carolina Stanley Cup will mean very little, actually, joined us from his temporary home in Hartford. Thanks, Sean.
All right, thank you very much, Bill.
Imagine New York without the Rangers, Philly without the Flyers, no Detroit Red Wings. So go to games, support your team, and while you're there, you buy ice cream. Let them know you care. Nordiques and the golden sails have left town. The Rockies and the North Stars have both disappeared. So support your team while we just dream of our golden years. Support your team.
Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant, Paul Pierce, Antoine Walker, not to mention Michael Jordan, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain. It may seem impossible to imagine a National Basketball Association without black stars. But just over 50 years ago, when the NBA was still regarded as second-rate entertainment, a handful of black players integrated the previously all-white league. San Francisco Examiner sports writer Ron Thomas has collected the stories of these players in a new book, They Cleared the Lane. He joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Ron, welcome to Only a Game.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's interesting to me that the impulse to begin researching and telling these stories came to you, at least in part, as a result of your learning that Chuck Cooper, one of the pioneers, had died before you could speak with him. In a way, I gather that this book kind of sprang from regret.
Well, you know, that's actually true. I think there are two regrets involved. One is about 1979 or so, I was in my office. At that time, I worked at the San Francisco Chronicle. And a wire story came across that we ran that day about Chuck Cooper being the first black player ever drafted in the NBA. And at that time, my regret was that I didn't know anything about Chuck Cooper beyond his name, which I'd heard before, but I didn't know any of the background of how he got drafted and why, and other. I didn't know who were the other players, actually black players, who entered the league at that time with him in 1950. So that was the first regret. And I just thought, I said to my editor at the time, gee, someday I'd love to interview Chuck Hooper and those other, first black players in the NBA. And then I never got around to it. And then I read another Wire Service story in 1984 saying that Cooper had died when he was 57. And at that point, I thought, you know, I better get onto this because these players are getting up in age. And, this is lost history each time one of these players passes away.
Chuck Cooper would be a lot of people's answer to the question, who was the first black ball player in the NBA? And it's not a bad answer, but I gather it's not a complete answer.
No, actually, there are three answers to that question. One answer is that, yes, Chuck Cooper was the first black player in the sense of being the first one drafted. And he was drafted in 1950 on the second round by the Boston Celtics. If you mean by that, who was the first black player to sign with the NBA, then that would be a player named Harold Hunter, who was drafted on, I think, the 10th or 11th round in the same draft by the Washington Capitals team. It turned out that Cooper and that Hunter and another player, Earl Lloyd, had a tryout with the Washington Capitals before the draft. And after that tryout, the Capitals signed them to contracts. And the coach who arranged the tryout, John McClendon, well, he was also the coach of Harold Hunter. Mm-hmm. So when it came time to sign the contracts, he said, Harold, you sign first because you're short. But in fact, he just wanted one of his own players to be the first black player to sign. So Hunter was the first black player to sign. And in fact, one of the sort of treasured items in my book is I have a photo of the contract that Harold Hunter signed. And now, if you want to ask who was the first black player to actually play in an NBA game, then that is Earl Lloyd. Now, Lloyd was drafted on the 9th round of the 1950 draft, again by the Washington Capitals. And Earl made the team. Hunter did not. And then on opening day, the Capitals happened to play, which is Halloween night of 1950. And so Earl played in that game. So he was the first black player to play in a game. And then the next night is a night that Cooper debuted with the Boston Celtics.
Ron, among the ironies that you find in researching your story is that Abe Saperstein, who owned and ran the Harlem Globetrotters for years and obviously employed many black basketball players, was in fact an enemy of an integrated NBA. Was that strictly a position based on his business interests?
As far as I know, it was. It was strictly the fact that his talent pool was black players. And basically, up until the NBA began to integrate, black players had two options. They could either play for Saperstein's Harlem Globetrotters, or they could play for a team called the New York Wrens, which was also sort of a barnstorming black team, but the Wrens didn't have the comedy routines that the Globetrotters had. So both of them were excellent teams. Both of them at one time won the World Championship of Basketball, which was played in the 30s and 40s in Chicago. And the thing was that the NBA teams depended greatly on Saperstein for revenue because they were really struggling for attendance. And if they played a doubleheader with the Globetrotters, then fans would come to see the Globetrotters, really, and they'd stick around for the NBA team. And so the teams originally had an unwritten ban on black players because they were afraid that if they signed black players, then Saperstein might refuse to play in their arena. And what happened was when Chuck Cooper was drafted by the Celtics, the next day there was an article in the Boston paper in which Saperstein said he would never play again in Boston Arena, to which the Boston Celtics owner, Walter Brown, to his credit, said he didn't care. And but it really did reflect how Saperstein really felt about the integration of the NBA.
So if Walter Brown perhaps hadn't said, I don't care, this is the right thing to do, or I don't care, this is the way I'm going to put a better team together, who knows? The integration might not have come along as quickly as it did.
Well, you know, he certainly made the big contribution by drafting Cooper. And if you talk to Earl Lloyd, he always defers to Cooper when someone asks who was the first black player. Because Lloyd says, if the Celtics hadn't drafted Cooper on the second round, I don't think the Capitals would have had the nerve to draft me on the 9th round. But really, the key to breaking the unwritten ban on black players was Ned Irish, who was the owner of the New York Knicks. He needed a center badly. Which, you know, is odd that 52 years later, here we are in the same situation.
It's just nothing changing, right?
But what happened is he went to an owners' meeting, and I think I don't have a specific date on it, but it must have been late 1949 or very early 1950. And he said, I want to sign Sweetwater Clifton. And I was told by a member of the Board of Governors at that time, Carl Bennett, that the owners voted him down. So then he comes back a few months later to another meeting. and says, you know, I still want to sign Sweetwater Clifton, and if you don't allow me to do that, I may pull the Knicks out of New York City. And so then the owners voted in favor of allowing him to sign Clifton and also said that Cooper could be drafted. So that actually broke the ban on black players. And it turned out that Ned Iris did sign Sweetwater Clifton a month after the NBA draft.
Even after the league was integrated and black players began to have the opportunity to have careers in the NBA, they couldn't stay in the same hotels with their white teammates in many cities. They couldn't eat in the same restaurants. Sometimes, at least, I gather the white players would not eat in places where their teammates were not welcome, a gesture that some of the men with whom you spoke still remember with considerable pride, I gather.
Well, I think we must remember this was a time period that preceded even Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that basically made illegal segregated schools. And then it's way before the civil rights legislation of the 1950s. So this is a time when segregation in hotels, restaurants, any area of life was very common. So when black players played particularly exhibition games in southern cities or in borderline cities like St. Louis or Fort Wayne, Indiana, they often ran up against segregation. And some black players were unfortunate in that their teammates would go into a restaurant and eat and maybe bring them a sandwich or something out of the restaurant, leave them on the team bus, let's say. But there are many other players who teammates would refuse to go into a restaurant if it wouldn't take all the players. One of the most heartwarming stories in the book occurred on Earl Lloyd's, I think, first road trip as an NBA player. The team went to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Earl was allowed to stay in the team hotel, but the hotel did not want him to come down and eat in the hotel restaurant. So he's sitting eating a room service meal, and he gets a knock on his door, and it's Bones McKinney, who's his head coach, who, you know, offered to come eat with Earl in his hotel room so Earl wouldn't be alone. And I think Earl told him something along the lines of, Bones, there's no reason for two of us to eat a funky meal. So you go back downstairs and eat in the restaurant. But it's a story that Earl talks about even today with great emotion in his voice because it really meant a lot to him.
Some of the former players with whom you spoke were quite sure that there was a quota system in place long after the league was integrated, a kind of unwritten agreement, I gather, which stipulated that no team would have more than three or four black players. Was it just the obvious presence of so many excellent black players that eventually scuttled that injustice?
I think that was it. I think there was more pressure to sign black players for several reasons. One is the Boston Celtics did not adhere to the quota. So first you had Chuck Cooper, and then you had the drafting of Bill Russell in 1956, and immediately the Celtics won a title. And then the Celtics added Casey Jones and Sam Jones and Sat Sanders. So the fact that they had so many black players and were winning championships, I think, put pressure on other teams to also sign black players. Basically, it put pressure on them to sign the best players available, and that included a lot more black players than they had been bringing in at the time. The other thing I think that was really important was the 1966 Texas El Paso victory over Kentucky in the NCAA championship. Mm-hmm. Because once again, that said to major colleges, if you want to continue to win these titles, then you've got to sign more black players. And when you had more black players coming into the Big Ten, the Pac-10, and eventually into Southern conferences, then you had more black players who were got a lot of publicity and were highly visible to NBA teams when it came to scouting and drafting.
Toward the end of the book, you talk with some of the current players in the NBA, and I'm not surprised, I guess, that they don't really have any idea who the first black players in the league were, but it's kind of sad, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. It's a little sad because I think this history of the integration of sports is really important from a social standpoint in addition to from an athletic standpoint. As I mentioned, this was a time of harsh segregation, and I think it's real easy for, well, certainly it's understandable that people living now, both black and otherwise, don't understand really what that was like. And I think having a chance to read about the daily experiences that black people had to go through in those days is just an important part of American history that we should know about. And it explains some of the, you know, the racial tension that still exists today and the racial skepticism and even some of the stereotyping that we, black people are still trying to overcome. I think the other thing is, I think it's important for players to understand that the moves they're making now, the spectacular plays they're making now, were not their own inventions. You know, it would be good for Vince Carter to know that when he goes into the air and makes a spectacular dunk, well, he probably, you know, got some of that idea, at least, from Julius Erving, who got some of that idea from Elgin Baylor, who was the first great black scorer in the NBA and the first player who was known really for you know, levitating and hesitating in the air. It's good for Jason Kidd to know that Guy Rogers was a great playmaker who, in terms of style, was very similar to Kidd. And I think it's good for players to know that a Magic Johnson was preceded by Oscar Robertson. And in fact, Magic's dad used to make him watch Oscar on TV because he said, you're going to be a tall point guard. This is the way they play. And then Oscar was sort of preceded by Maurice Stokes, who was a great black player in the early 50s, who was 6'7", averaged 16 points, 16 rebounds, and I think 5 assists for 3 years, and then suffered a career-ending and later fatal brain injury. So there isn't, I don't think, anything completely new in basketball now, and I think it'd be good for players to know that.
Ron Thomas covers the NBA for the San Francisco Examiner. His book is entitled They Cleared the Lane, the NBA's Black Pioneers. It's published by University of Nebraska Press. Ron, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for over 10 years. Detailed information on current computer virus threats available at sophos.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Seasons 4 in Lexington for over 30 years, providing everything unique for the garden, from uncommon plant materials and garden furniture to classic urns and statuary. 781-861-1200. By North Shore Magnetic Imaging Center, providing MRI services for over 14 years with locations in Peabody, Beverly, and Salem. On the web at nsmic.org. And by the 24th Cambridge River Festival, an outdoor celebration of the arts featuring music, dance, visual art, and food. Saturday, June 15, from noon to 6 p.m. Information at cambridgeartscouncil.org. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Celtics season came to an end last night as the New Jersey Nets won the Eastern Conference title by beating the Seas 96-88. The Red Sox beat the Yankees 5-2 last night. The two teams play again in New York this afternoon. A doubleheader in Major League Soccer at CMGI Stadium in Foxborough this evening. Women take the field at 4 as the Boston Breakers host Washington at 6:30. 30 men will be on the field as the New England Revolution hosts San Jose. In World Cup soccer, Senegal upset defending champion France 1-0. Ireland and Cameroon tied at 1-1 this morning. Denmark beat Uruguay 2-1. The game between Germany and Saudi Arabia is just getting underway. Join NPR's Sylvia Poggioli for a trip to Cuba on our next Citizens of the World Tour. Call 800-909-9287.
This is Bob Oakes. We'd all like to make our money go farther. Here's a way to make a contribution that can double in value. This spring, your gift through the mail will be worth twice as much when we encourage other listeners to match it during our June fundraiser. When our letter arrives asking for your contribution, and maybe it already has, remember your pledge to WBUR today can be doubled later this month. Please send in your check today and make a smart investment in quality news. Thanks.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a form of polo which has its adherents swapping mallets for paddles. But first, Only a Game analyst Charlie Pierce joins me this week from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis to discuss the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. And, you know, we thought that the French lost that automatic surrender reflex in the last century, but apparently not.
Well, Senegal proved otherwise. You're right. In an intriguing bit of off-field baseball news, Charlie, Ken Caminiti, the National League's MVP back in 1996, said this week that he was taking steroids that season. Major League Baseball, unlike the NFL and the NBA, has no rule against steroids, though the drugs are illegal without a prescription. Does Caminiti's disclosure alter the landscape any?
Well, I think it's gone off in so many directions at this point, it can almost not help but alter the landscape. It will certainly be another card in the deck during the upcoming labor holocaust. He's already backing over the percentage he gave to Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated. Now he's saying he's not sure it's 50%. He just sort of threw that out there. Baseball and steroids have an interesting relationship because, unlike football, for example, batters, who are primarily the focus of this, or there is some talk about pitchers now, don't compete against each other except in the statistical tables. If I take steroids, I hit more home runs than you do. But I don't have a direct impact upon what you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like football where if I take steroids and you're and I'm a defensive lineman and you're an offensive lineman and you don't, I can kill you. So baseball has been slow to come to this issue. The problem I have with the whole controversy is that it's a matter of everybody knowing and everybody not knowing. And anybody who thinks testing will solve that problem, they're just wrong.
Asked to comment on Ken Caminiti's statement, San Francisco Giants slugger Barry Bonds said, quote, "What players take doesn't matter. Doctors should spend their time looking for cures for cancer." Charlie, isn't it the case that some doctors working on cancer are studying the carcinogenic effects of steroids?
That was an infelicitous analogy by Barry Bonds, who has a gift for them. Again, and we've talked about this before, you wind up with a very interesting philosophical conundrum when you talk about drugs in sports. There are certain drugs taken in en masse which are not healthy for the human body, without which major league sports would not take place. You have pitchers taking cortisone shots in their shoulder the way some of us gulp M&Ms. And the problem with that is, of course, corticosteroids have been linked to a lot of blood-related diseases, including an accelerated development of blood clots, which can be enormously dangerous. It is impossible to argue ethically that it is ethical to take a drug that makes your performance possible, but unethical to take one simply because it makes your performance better.
There was a lot of very ugly behavior, Charlie, on the part of fans during the Eastern Conference Finals in the NBA. Was it because neither the Nets nor the Celtics have had recent playoff success, or is this just further proof that there are a lot of idiots out there in NBA arenas as well as elsewhere?
You know, it's become part of the public sanction if you break the law that you become the subject of abuse by drunken yahoos in sports arenas if you happen to be an athlete. I'm not entirely sure I have a problem with that, given the fact that a lot of people who commit some of the offenses that the athletes commit would be in jail and not being cheered by anyone. I find it odd, however, that part of the public sanction for something you've done is that the woman, in this case, in the case of Jason Kidd's wife, the woman who was abused gets tormented in the stands
by
a fan, much less that a number of people in my profession seem to think it's okay and seem to take, you know, people off the hook for their behavior just because they buy a ticket to a sports event.
In Cleveland, speaking of the NBA, they're trying to figure out who's going to coach the first two games of the next basketball season. It won't be head coach John Lucas, who has been suspended and fined for working out LeBron James, the nation's top but ineligible prospect. Does this tarnish Lucas's otherwise quite positive image and reputation?
No, I don't think so. They certainly threw the pamphlet at the Cavaliers. They fined him $150,000. Lucas will lose the first two games of the year, probably two games he doesn't care about to start with. It is an indication, though, that the NBA is worried that should a high school junior decide to enter the draft, they will lose that case in court.
Does the news of former Celtics player, coach, general manager, and corporate shakedown guy ML Carr's appointment as president of the WNBA Charlotte Sting indicate anything other than that he's been appointed president of the Charlotte Sting?
Well, I think corporate shakedown guy's a bit harsh, isn't it? I mean, it gives him sort of a brown paper bag feeling about the whole thing. I think it's an indication that he's returning to his roots. He's from North Carolina, and that yes, indeed, he and Larry Bird will somehow get things together and get an arena built, and he will be in charge of some element of a future NBA expansion franchise in Charlotte.
I've always thought Charlotte should have an NBA team. There is apparently some possibility that the NBA will institute a replay mechanism into the officiating process at some point. Charlie, Commissioner Stern said this week, quote, "The game has gotten too fast for our officials to see everything." Does that seem to you an accurate explanation for the officiating we've seen?
I think it is an accurate explanation for some of the terrible officiating. I'm not sure that the cure is not worse than the disease here. I want to see the fine print on what exactly can be replayed and what can't. I would hate to see every block charge call, for example, subject to a beanbag toss from the sidelines, much less give some of these people who coach NBA teams a projectile to throw is asking for all kinds of trouble.
On Tuesday, three Calgary men were sent to the hospital with mallet wounds after a vicious brawl erupted between croquet and softball players who've been using the same field. "I didn't realize croquet was a contact sport," said one Calgary policeman. Charlie, did you realize that?
I did not either, but apparently the croquet people are better at sports equipment brawling than the softball people were if everybody that went to the hospital went for mallet wounds.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine and for Esquire magazine, and the épée is his weapon of choice. Thank you, Charlie.
Hey, I'm going to send your head over there, eh?
Though it's not a service we had in mind when the program began almost 9 years ago, Only a Game has introduced lots of listeners to sports they'd perhaps never otherwise have known. It's time to do that again now, thanks to the work this week of Only a Game's Karen Given.
It's Thursday in Arlington, Massachusetts, a suburb just north of Boston. The sun is shining and a light, cool breeze is coming off the water. A group of about 15 kayakers have fought their way through rush hour traffic to get to Spy Pond, but they've been rewarded with a perfect evening for a leisurely paddle. Tom slides his boat into the water and makes his way towards his friends a few yards from shore. Before long, it becomes obvious that there's nothing leisurely about what these paddlers plan to do here.
No, kayak polo is definitely not a stroll in the park, that's for sure.
Lisa Newman heads the New England kayak polo women's team.
It's a very exciting sport. You can kind of think of it sort of as playing hockey and water polo in kayaks would be a good cross-explanation of it. When you're playing kayak polo, people throw you the ball, and that's how you move it up the court. But when you have that ball, you have 5 seconds to get rid of it, and people can come and push you over. Anyone can come and paddle on top of your kayak to stop you from paddling with it or keep the ball away or try and get the ball away from you.
The concept of kayak polo isn't hard to grasp. It's basically water polo played in kayaks. Still, players tend to compare aspects of the game to almost every mainstream sport. There are substitutions, as in hockey. When an opponent intentionally rolls your kayak to get the ball away from you, it's called a tackle. Some claim that the playing area was inspired by a soccer pitch, only on a lake or swimming pool. To make things more interesting, the goals, about 3 feet tall by 5 feet wide, are suspended 6.5 feet, or one paddle length, in the air. The game begins with a tip-off, much like in basketball. One player from each team tries for the ball. But unlike basketball, both paddlers start at their own goal. The referee releases the ball in the middle of the pitch, and the paddlers sprint toward it, sometimes with impressive results.
A lot of times, the ball floats on top of the water, but in order to get at the ball, you have to lean all the way over on the side of your boat with your hands out to grab the ball. That's going to flip you. You'll flip underwater, and you come back up the other side, hopefully with the ball.
Games are short, just 10 minutes a half. But Lisa Newman cautions against assuming that a short game is somehow an easy game.
When you're in a game, you're never standing still at all. You're always out there sprinting somewhere. It's a lot of sprinting, endurance work, always moving your hands and paddling everywhere.
Watch out, Andy's coming up.
Mary Beth Connolly has only been playing for a year. Already, she's an accomplished member of the women's team. She's still struggling with explaining her passion to family and friends.
Typically, it's what? I don't understand. How do you play that? Is it in kayaks? Do you all have kayaks? Is it in a pool? Is it in a pond? They typically have to show pictures to make a little bit more sense. And I've even had a couple of people go, oh, wait, so you play kayak water polo together? I thought you kayaked and you played water polo as two separate activities.
Like the devotees of many unusual sports and the music of David Hasselhoff, kayak polo enthusiasts insist their sport is big in Europe. It's an irony not lost on newcomer Rob Stiles.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I used to play drums in a punk band, and it was always that way. Like, oh, yeah, they're huge in Europe, you know, and the funny thing is I raced bicycles for 13 years before doing this, and yet again, you know, it's huge in Europe, you know, so, you know, you can sort of, I guess, you know, relish in the fact that there are a large group of people somewhere who are coming out and applauding the sport. So, you know, it doesn't make you feel quite so on the fringe.
If the number of international players on the New England team is any indication, the sport really is more popular in Europe. The team includes Brits, New Zealanders, and even Italian Andy Gasparini, who came to the U.S. just 2 years ago.
And luckily, I found a club in the area, so I was really thrilled about, very excited about, because, you know, I thought I lost my sport, and here I am playing again.
While the U.S. has a little more than a dozen kayak polo clubs across the country, Gasparini says that Italy boasts close to 100 teams. That number is even higher in Great Britain and other European countries. Different forms of the game have been played across Europe for decades, but international rules were only adopted 10 years ago. Since then, Gasparini says, the popularity of the game has skyrocketed. A former rower, Gasparini says kayak polo, with its fast breaks, underwater tackles, and broad combination of skills, has an obvious appeal.
It's not boring at all. I mean, you have fun even training. It requires a lot of skills, but you don't think about when you play. You just have fun, and you forget about the pain. It's not like other sports where, you know, you train and train for hours, and you get kind of frustrated. This one, you never are. I mean, I've been doing it for 9 years, and I'm still here, so it means that there's something good about it.
Ex-Brit Ian Clark has been playing even longer, hitting the water for the first time in 1976.
We played in fiberglass boats in England in a little university pool. And the boats were made, as I say, of fiberglass. And if you wore shorts, you'd get all the fiberglass in your legs and you ended up itching for the rest of the evening.
While many members of the New England kayak polo team are quite competitive, having won multiple national championships and played on the U.S. team, Clark comes here for humbler reasons.
You know, I spend all day pushing a mouse and a keyboard around at work, and I was very glad to come out here this evening and just sort of work off some of the frustrations that occur in the workplace.
Next weekend at the University of New Hampshire, the New England team will host the national championships and try to defend their U.S. title. That might be easier said than done. According to club chairman Joe Mikulski, some players are finding that hosting a tournament gets in the way of practice time.
This is harder than organizing a 150-person wedding. This is amazing to us. I mean, we're trying to organize teams coming in from overseas, plus local teams, getting the boats and the equipment here, setting up the pitch, getting the college to kind of cooperate with us. So it's quite an ordeal, really.
Also at the national finals, the team's top members are trying out for the U.S. national team, which will represent the country at this summer's World Championships in Germany. The U.S. will lose, of course. After all, Mikulski says, the sport is much bigger in Europe.
We're not the worst country in the world, but we're down there. We're definitely in the lower echelon, unfortunately.
Who's the worst?
It all depends on what poor new country decides to join the Worlds that year. Last year, it happened to be Argentina. God bless them. They came over to the Brazilian Worlds. The World Championships were held in Brazil, and they took some beatings. The American team actually even beat them 22-1. So we that was one of our biggest victories ever in world competition.
Beyond dreams of someday playing on the national team, Mary Beth Connolly is just hoping that the Nationals will give her friends and family the opportunity to see her sport in person and finally understand what she's been doing for the past year.
Yeah, I'm going to send out the schedule and let them know when I'm playing, and hopefully, the nice thing is they won't know enough to know whether or not I'm playing well or badly, so it'll just be interesting for them.
The Kayak Polo National Championships will be held from June 7th through the 9th in Durham, New Hampshire. Teams from 5 states and 4 countries will compete in the men's, women's, development, and international divisions. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Arlington, Massachusetts.
Longer boats are coming to win us, they're coming to win us, they're coming to win us. The longer boats are coming to win us, hold on to the shore.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Dave Schneider, the guitar-playing goalie, and from Mary Edwards at KWMU in St. Louis and Paul Lancour at KQED in San Francisco. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter or paddle with the poloists. Please visit our website, www.onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from kayak polo enthusiast and Only a Game fan, Rob Stiles.
I can't tell you how many times I was listening and I thought, you know, I should call Bill Littlefield and let him know about kayak polo, because this is, you know, just a marginal enough, you know, an odd enough sport that I'm sure he'll take interest.
Odd? Marginal? Skillet tossing may be odd, and belt sander racing might be marginal, but kayak polo's mainstream. Get it? Stream? Ah, well. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Longer boats are coming to win us. They're coming to win us. They're coming to win us. Longer boats are coming to win us. Hold on to the shore. They'll be taking the key from the door.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Strategic Science and Technologies Incorporated, creators of Warm Cream, a patented cream for relief of cold hands and feet, naturally. Available on the web, warmcream.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.